Thank you very much. Good morning. It's a pleasure being here. For those who don't know, I recently moved to Hangzhou in China, and this is a picture from Hangzhou. It's the West Lake, which is very beautiful, but probably doesn't really match up to the scenery outside. The work I'm going to talk about is scanning tunneling my scope work from Dresden, my former employer. And if I get this to work. Yeah, okay, so this is the outline of my talk. I start with the quantum critical heavy fermion system, ytterbium, rhodium, to silicon tube, and present some old and some new work, some STM work. Then I very briefly flash some results on cm kappa indium 5, which is superconducting, because after all, this is a superconductivity meeting. And this gives me the opportunity to talk about yet another heavy fermion system, the first unconventional heavy fermion superconductor. In fact, probably the first unconventional electronic superconductor ever discovered, cm kappa 2 silicon 2. And this leads to some, well, let's say, riddle concerning the kinetic energy loss as the system enters the superconducting state. And then I return to STM and propose that this might help to shed some light on this. Okay, so as I mentioned, that was work done in Dresden at the Max Planck Institute for Chemical Physics of Solids in the group of Steffen Wirth. I also show some data by Oliver Stockert, who does primarily neutron scattering. And this is a collaboration with Chimasi, one of our co-organizers. All right. So I assume that part of the conference covered the heavy fermion superconductors. But let me briefly introduce the main player of the first part of the talk, ytterbium, rhodium, to silicon 2. Probably you are familiar with the two types of quantum criticality that seem to be present in the heavy fermion systems. One is the standard spin density wave scenario, where the magnetic phase is entered from the heavy fermion paramagnetic side through a quantum critical point at zero temperature. And because it's just a spin density wave, the quasi-particles, the heavy quasi-particles, remain intact, and one has to go much deeper into the antiferromagnetic phase to destroy Condor's field. And it's believed, and I give some evidence during the talk, that cm kappa to indium 5 is in this group, but also cm kappa to silicon 2. So they are spin density wave antiferromagnets. On the other hand, there are unconventional magnets among the heavy fermions. This goes back to work by Chimiao and Pierce. And in this case, the magnetic state at zero temperature, so when the lattice becomes critical, is concomitant with a zero temperature separate breakoff of the quasi particles and a mod localization of the 4F moments. So here the magnetic state is a sort of disentangled state between the F moments and the conduction electrons. And there are a number of systems that belong to this group, the sort of closely related or sister compounds, cm rhodium, indium 5, related to this system. And the most famous compound in this class is ytterbium rhodium to silicon 2. And that's what I'm going to talk about. Yeah.
Can neutron scattering distinguish between these two?
In principle, yes. So far, neutron scattering has been done for this compound, but I think there's not even consensus on the ordering wave vector. But I'll show some neutron scattering data on this compound, and that clearly shows it's a spin density wave. Yeah.
Stefan, just to clarify, so for example, in cm cobalt indium 5, what is the tuning parameter? Do they apply pressure?
You can apply pressure, you can also apply magnetic field.
Okay. So let's say you applied either of those, and then, so you're saying the whole measurement was done, and the place where the Hall coefficient jumps is not the same as where the criticality occurs, okay? Is that the implication?
You're talking about this compound now?
Yeah.
maybe I'm not understanding the question. So,
well, you put it in the first class of Horstmann's Marine scenario, right? And as this figure clarifies, the dashed line where the Fermi surface volume curve changes is not the same. It does not go to QCP. So I was wondering what's the evidence for that.
I don't think there's solid evidence in the case of Cm Kappa 2 indium 5. It's suspected that it belongs to this class. There's much stronger evidence for Cm Kappa 2 silicon 2. Okay.
But I think the question is, do you actually see the dotted line that you've drawn?
In these two systems, there's no clear indication that this line has been seen. But at the very end for this compound, I come back to this line, and then we can talk about this then. Okay. But for now, I want to focus on the turbine loading two. So this is a system that condenses in this tetragonal structure. And this is the resistivity. One sees some maximum at around 100 Kelvin and zero field. And it's known that the system orders magnetically at very low temperature. It has a tiny moment, just given here. And this suggests that one can easily tune it to a critical point, a quantum critical point, by, for example, applying a magnetic field. And depending on the direction of the magnetic field, with respect to the crystal axis, it's 60 millitesla or 0.66 tesla. And for the STM data in field, this will be the direction of the field. Okay. Now, this is some specific heat data, again, zero magnetic field. And one sees that it the specific heat diverges in a T log T fashion, down to something of the order of 0.03 Kelvin, and then sort of shows a steep upturn. For later reference, also note that at around 3 Kelvin, there's nothing particular is seen in the specific data. As you know, in these 4F systems, spin orbit coupling is large, and that implies that the J for our ytterbium is 7.5. And correspondingly, the turbine is 840 degenerate. This degeneracy is, of course, further reduced by crystal field electric effects, and this can be seen in the spin entropy obtained from the specific heat. The main message I want to convey here is that around 50 Kelvin, one has something of the order of R log 2, which means the corresponding TK would be, depending on which criteria you use, something of the order of 30 Kelvin. If you go to around 100 Kelvin, then one recovers 2R ln2, and that means there's a second crystal field duplet that comes into play. So, these were, I guess, some of the data that Andre was referring to. So this shows the unconventional nature of ytterbium rhodium 2 silicon 2, which here is the Hall coefficient that shows on the large field side a value which corresponds to a very comparatively large carrier concentration. So this is the relation between the two. Whereas in zero magnetic field at low temperatures, the Hall coefficient is much larger, and correspondingly the carrier concentration is less, and that suggests that there's something going on near the critical point, which is shown here. And if one extrapolates these curves down to zero temperature, then they indicate that there is a jump in the Hall coefficient and correspondingly a Fermi surface reconstruction at the critical point. If one analyzes these curves a little bit further and looks at their width as a function of temperature, this is shown in this plot here, one finds that the characteristic width, the full width half maximum of these curves is proportional to temperature, and that is in line with the fact that the single particle relaxation rate is proportional to temperature, and that this feature is part of the critical slowing down as one approaches the critical point. Okay.
What is sigma gamma g was measured by Arcus? Is that the
No, this is from simply from the data here from the Hall measurements.
Oh, that's okay. That's just a bit.
Yeah.
Okay.
So this is the phase diagram.
So you have a capacitor band in the Hall location, which you can use on the transfer curve.
Yeah.
Is the capacitor band is it following the normal rules?
No.
If you remind me what the normal rules are.
Well, all angle is relaxed away. Some relaxation rate square, and then there's the sigma xx.
Mm-hmm.
So that is what I'm saying is you assume that the relaxation rate that is coming in sigma xy is the same as that in sigma xx.
Yeah.
Okay. That assumption is fine.
Good. So this is the phase diagram for this material as a function of magnetic field. And in blue are the Fermi liquid phases. This is the anti-Fermi magnet. So blue means resistivity shows a T-squared behavior. And orange indicates that transport is anomalous and has a linear NT behavior. Note that the temperature scales are extremely low, and if one wants to zoom in to this quantum critical state to probe the microscopic physics, then one needs an appropriate tool, and since the temperatures are very low, photon electron spectroscopy is out, and since the magnetic fields are very small, the Hartmann alpha is also out, and that sort of leaves the STM as an appropriate tool. And STM recently, a few years ago, has become available for these heavy fermion systems. It started with this hidden order compound and was then followed up by this work by Steffen Wirth on turbine rolling to silicon II. And subsequently, there was also some theoretical work on this. And some of the things that Steffen saw are shown here. This is the surface. And in principle, from looking at the surface and the symmetry, one cannot distinguish between a silicon terminated surface and an ytterbium terminated surface. They would look the same. But by analyzing the defect structure, for example, this corresponds to the blue curve here, and this yellow path is the orange path here.
Just an occasional question. Since I'm not doing heavy fermions, I just remember vaguely that at some point of time, maybe long ago, there was this issue that tunneling from F electron, if you take at face value, should have huge barrier for tunneling into normal metal because of very large Fermi surface mismatch. Is that something that turned out to be not true? Or I mean, what the situation with that? If you just use standard expression for tunneling, so that is function barrier, square barrier, then there is effective tunneling resistance, which is defined by Fermi surface velocity mismatch. So if you have hugely different Fermi surface velocities, then in this formal expression, there is a very, very large barrier resistance. And I remember at some point of time that was discussed.
I'm not aware of this. No? I'm simply not aware of it. I don't see that there's an issue with this. No? So, but looking at the defect structure, one can infer that this is a silicon-terminated surface. And on the surface, then, this is the spectrum one sees, the conductance, as a function of the applied bias voltage. And if one moves the tip over the surface, one also sees that basically this pattern does not depend on the position of the tip. Mm-hmm. And I will come back to this and sort of explain why we think that this means that there's no tunneling into the ytterbiums directly. Okay, so if one now analyzes what is being measured by the STM, then this is the sort of linear response expression one gets for the current as a function of voltage. And this is the local density of states of a operator that is given here. It's a linear superposition of the F and C states. And the picture is that if one brings the tip close by, one can either tunnel into the system through the F states or through the conduction electron states. And plugging this in and looking at the, so this is the local DOS, evaluating this expression, one sees that in general, there should be some dependence on the tip position indicated by R to with reference to the F states. So off-diagonal elements of the conduction electron Queen's function should enter. If one ignores this, which I will do in the following, and simply say that I take the same position of tip and the F moments, then this sort of simplifies to this expression. And if one at least at the DMFT level tries to pin down what the conduction electron Queen's function is, then one can recast this into an expression like this. And that says that in principle it's some sort of self-avoiding loop that the electron does. It's self-avoiding because once one hits one of the F states, one includes all local diagrams. And this is the local T matrix. And for the following, I will simply truncate this expression after the first non-trivial state, which then means it's sort of an impurity model that I look at. Okay? And if one does this and solves such an impurity model with some approximation, one finds the following. So shown here is the depth of the zero bias feature as a function of temperature. This is the blue curve. And this NCA calculation lies more or less on top of it and indicates that what one sees with the zero bias gap is sort of single impurity contour physics and first approximation and has some scale which is at the order of 100 Kelvin. And this refers to the spin entropy I showed earlier, that at these temperatures, there's a second crystal field excitation, there's a second duplet coming into play. And as I said, I assumed that I only tunnel into conduction electron states from the point of calculation at this point, that wouldn't really matter at all. So that's just interesting. Okay.
Sorry, yeah. We're not seeing agreement here. This is all external data, right?
No. The red one here is an NCA calculation.
Ah, that's red. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. So it's only comparing the zero bias gap as you go down.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you. Nothing else. But I will now turn to the other features that I indicated here, these sort of tiny peaks or ripples in the data. Okay? One can also with this approximation explain them. Mm-hmm. So, as I said, there are crystal field excitations, and in the lattice they are split up into four duplets, and their energy is known from neutron scattering. So these are the crystal field excitations, and they are having this energy. And that means that at very, very high temperatures, the contour temperature one would see should be very large, because at very high temperatures I can ignore this splitting. So this is the TK high. Whereas at very low temperatures, I should mainly see contour physics coming from the lowest duplet. So this is referred to as TK low. And from this argument, one can infer that, well, TK high should be much larger than TK low. Okay? Not too surprising. And one can...
Can it matter if there's an ytterbium ion at the surface, it doesn't see the full crystal field?
That's right. And the argument will be the fact that one actually sees these features in the STM means STM at this case probes bulk. But so there are two aspects to this. First of all, crystal field excitations, they are atomic energy, so they should be much, much larger. They should per se not be detectable by STM around zero energy. And this is what I will address on the next, I don't know, one or two slides. And then the conclusion is that since these are crystal field-related excitations, it means STM does probe light in this case. And they are all features of single impurity physics in some sense. Okay.
So the low temperature limit, is that sort of NCA anomaly in the theory? Very low temperature scale, do you have to worry about or not?
Yeah, so this is a mean field result. Yeah. It has nothing to do with NCA.
Okay.
I'm not pushing the NCA results any further, because NCA will give you a non-Fermi liquid and these anomalies at very low temperatures. Yeah. And since I include these levels in finite U, there are even more issues with this approximation. I'm only using the NCA results to say there's something that is sort of single ytterbium physics. And it helps me to sort of make a distinction between what later on will be a lattice effect in the spike system and what can be understood with some high temperature sort of approach.
Okay. And there should be multiple, it's also at higher energy, right? So
So at very high energies, you would expect to really see these levels. And but there's beyond the experiment on STM. And as far as I know, STM has never seen crystal field excitations. The maybe let me go to the fact that you see here something which has the same level splitting or the same distance and energy is essentially quantum physics. So that's the point I want to make on this slide, that if you take a simple model where you have not only one local level but several local levels that with a degeneracy that is split, for example, by crystal field excitations, and you solve that impurity model, for example, in mean field, then already at the mean field level, you will see that, so you decouple on the mean field level, and then these high energy features, the I labels the crystal field excitations, are shifted down, and typically the one level in mean field with which you do that would make the Kondo resonance, but now since we have several of them, they are all shifted by the same parameter, and that means we get additional Kondo resonances, and their distance should sort of reflect the crystal field excitation splitting. That's the argument. And
well, once so I'm saying there, you say there are four doublets, there are states, but I have one F state size 28, right? There should be many more, even at higher energy.
That's right, but
that should not couple really into this.
Absolutely. So what we just saw, this is on the scale of the Kondo energy. This is the Kondo resonance. And this is the energy scale that we look at in the STM experiment. These are the crystal field levels. And for the higher energy states, because they have already been taken into account because of the spin orbit coupling, which is the largest energy scale. So here we already have looked at just at the J equal 7.5 state. So they are at even much higher energy.
But are they visible in STM?
Not even these energies are visible in STM. The atomic energies which show crystal field excitation. The only thing that is visible is that once they are shifted down and are renormalized, so what you see is a Kondo resonance which reflects this splitting. You're not actually seeing these states. They are way higher in energy.
And you're going to tell us what shifts them down?
Kondo physics, as I said.
You're going to calculate that?
Yeah, here it's the mean field calculation. They are just shifted. Of course, once you do something more elaborate, you have to invert matrices and stuff. But this is an NCA calculation of the same thing, and you see the mean field goes through. Okay? Is that okay? Okay. So now That means that in this STM spectrum, one sees the zero bias gap, which starts to open at around 100 Kelvin, which is this high TK when the second duplet comes into play. And one sees the additional peaks here, here, and here, and in this one, and their distance is exactly the crystal field excitation splitting that is known from neutron scattering. And this, together with what I just said, means that these features are a reflection of the crystal field excitations, and therefore this is bio physics.
So, Shankar, didn't you just say 5 minutes ago that you don't know of any example of a STM actually seeing crystal fields? And I was saying that's exactly what they are.
No, what I'm saying is that, so this is a reflection of condor physics, the condor resonance, if you wish,
right.
Seen from the conduction electron physics, mm-hmm. if you wish, okay? Now, but you have crystal field excitations, you're not having just one atomic level, okay? So each of these crystal field split levels will make a condor resonance, mm-hmm. and their distance will remain more or less, I mean, you get self-energy corrections to them, so the hybridization will sort of come in. But by and large, they will have the same splitting as the crystal field excitations.
Are you saying that these two numbers in that plot?
Which two numbers?
PK low and PK high? I see very...
Yeah. So if you could...
25 volts is 25 degrees.
Yeah. So...
Will you get this from experiment?
You see this in experiment. In principle, you also see the crystal field excitations.
Do I see it in the conductance?
Yeah. If you follow, look. I mean, if we go back to this, if you trace this feature, so the curve you saw was this blue curve. If you follow it as a function of temperature, and you follow this dip, then this is so the blue one here is experiment. This is where you see the 100 dK, okay? For example, so I mean, of course, in principle, if you have the spectral function, you should also try to see it in sort of the width. But we are not simply probing the 4F spectral function with STM. So, okay. But the point that I want to discuss, which is probably more interesting, is that there is an additional feature which so far is neither related to this crystal field condor resonances or this zero bias gap, which is around minus 6 MeV. And that appears at 30 Kelvin. So if you wish, also the TK low, you see in this curve because there's this feature.
Why all that is only visible in negative biases?
So if you look at this, you would think that so this is for a sort of serum system, this calculation, and there the condor resonance will always sit above the Fermi energy. And the higher excited states will be even further up in energy. Ytterbium is a whole system. So if you wish, you have to do particle hole excitation. In addition, these are labeled epsilon prime peaks. We have sort of Stokes and anti-Stokes peaks. But since the Fermi function and the occupation enters, they should be much suppressed. Okay. So in principle, one would think that there is a reflection of this, but it comes with an occupation, which is... So the simple answer is ytterbium is a whole system, and that's why you see it below. Okay, so now there's this additional peak at minus 6 MeV, and that is not coming out of any generalized NCA or whatever calculation that only takes the naive approach of single impurity physics. And therefore, one would probably assume that that's a feature of lattice physics. Now, if one takes that serious and goes to, for example, renormalized band structure calculations, which assume that one has a Fermi liquid and which assumes that everything that happens in this heavy fermion is due to condor physics, one finds the following quasi-particle density of states. And this density of states has nothing at minus 6 MeV, but it has a sort of hybridization gap or hybridization pseudo gap at minus 2 MeV. Okay? And since this is a sort of phenomenological approach, which needs some input from the experiment and then makes an assumption, so it's reasonable to assume that this minus 6 MeV feature is related to this hybridization gap at minus 2 MeV. Okay? Good. Now, one way to follow up on this idea is to say, well, let's study the temperature dependence of this feature. As we lower the temperature further, and the experiment can only go down to 0.3 Kelvin, this is the base temperature, and these are the data shown from 30 Kelvin down to this base temperature, and what one finds is that the 6 MeV feature continues to grow and sharpen up. The black curves refer to the CEF condo resonances. Okay? And this sharpening up and this temperature evolution is consistent with the fact that the system is not in a semi-liquid state, as we saw earlier looking at the transport data or looking at the specific heat. Okay. If one analyzes this peak further, as is shown here as a function of temperature, one finds that both the width and the peak show some rapid evolution at around 3 Kelvin. Okay. So the peak sort of increases rapidly and the width drops further, which is interesting because neither the resistivity nor specific heat shows any feature at 3 Kelvin. I referred to it earlier. But there is a bike property which does show something at 3 Kelvin, which is the thermal power. And that, first of all, says that, yeah, the 6 MeV feature is a bike property. And furthermore, it's somehow traced by the thermal power. So this is the thermal power data as a function of temperature. This is roughly 3 Kelvin, and one sees this rapid increase. And this itself is not being published, but there is a paper discussing the thermal power in YIS. And it makes the point that the thermal power in the system shows features which are not reflected in the gamma coefficient in the specific heat. And that is unconventional because for a standard two-dimensional spin density wave critical point, one would expect both increase and diverge similarly. This also indicates that maybe because we see a feature that is seen in the thermal power, which shows features of criticality at much lower temperatures, maybe this 6 MeV peak will also reveal features of critical physics if we follow it as a magnetic field. So if one does this, then one finds the following data. This is this peak at a function of applied magnetic field. Remember that the critical field was 0.66 Tesla, and this T star line is being crossed because the magnetic field is applied along the z-axis at around 1.3 Tesla. And now plotting the width as a function of field, as they come from these data, one finds the following, and there's a sharpening up or narrowing of the width once one crosses the B star line, which is compatible with the fact that there's critical slowing down, and as a consequence of that, the sharpening up. Okay? So these are the results on YIS. Just to summarize, STM does measure, in this case, bike properties. One can sort of trace the evolution of the condor lattice, and one can relate the features to bike measurements. Thermal power, for example, or the resistivity. And one does see the onset of critical slowing down in the field data. Okay, so now I want to turn to cerium copper indium 5, which is superconducting and which is a member of the 115 family, all of which are superconducting. And these are the respective transition temperatures. They have a 2D electronic structure, and it seems that in cerium copper indium 5, the transition is STW-like, whereas in cm rhodium 5, it's of the unconventional type. And Stefan analyzed the...
What are two-dimensional?
The electronic structure. If you do DFT calculations, then... the electronic structure, if you look at the Fermi surface, it looks 2D-like.
From experimenting both of them?
Both of them, and that's DFT calculations.
In measurements, what's the ratio of, let's say, this far away from technicality, the ratio of resistivities?
I have no idea what that is.
It's too much. I don't think we'll appreciate that. Nothing we distinct is that in that situation.
Trying to contrast the two.
It's difficult to contrast.
There's no kind of
resistivity. There is no contrast. I don't remember the ratio. There's also, you could also look at the ratio of thermal conductivity to stability and fiber. My collection is it's less than 10. Right, there are C on the low and D, but I don't remember the levels.
Anyway, so if one looks at the tunneling spectrum in the superconducting state, this is shown here, coming from the lowest temperatures, one finds that it fits very well with this D-type symmetry, and that the feature persists. So remember, the TC is around 2.3 Kelvin, and this shows that there's a pseudo gap above the superconducting transition temperature. And if one analyzes the parameters of the fit, this is shown here, for example, in this red curve, one concludes that the gap fully vanishes, or coming from below, at around 3.3 Kelvin. And this then also implies that gap ratio over TC is very large. It's far away from the resistance. Okay. For this compound, there are also inelastic neutron scattering data that have been measured. And one of the conclusions of this paper was that there's strong evidence that the superconductivity here comes from the antiferromagnetic spin fluctuations that drive the transition. And this is reminiscent of work from Preston on this CM Kappa 2 silicon 2. Okay? So I would like to discuss, therefore, the work done on this compound.
Yeah, which CM Kappa 2 5, did they fit the measured inelastic spectrum, some functional form, or functional?
Not to my knowledge. They inferred from, so they studied the spin exchange in a model which sort of did not take quantum physics into account.
Yeah,
and
but yeah. You said the neutron scattering experiment.
If you go to that paper, they are not even discussing any Magnon features, which may or may not be there. There's no mentioning of fitting of the full spectrum. And that's why I would like to turn to this one, because I think that's more solid.
I'm sorry, did you say what gap depth means?
It means, so if you sort of fit the envelope here, then the gap is this one.
Be D-wave? This means just thermal body?
So this is D wave, and it's fitted with this formula.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. And what's so it? You hit with this formula, delta is not zero, but gamma increases.
Gamma is roughly, well, it does increase a little bit, but it's roughly temperature independent. Yeah. So there's temperature problem in the instrument. Okay. So coming to CM Kappa 2 silicon 2 and to this kinetic energy loss. This is the phase diagram of CM Kappa 2 silicon 2, which has antiferromagnetic phase and superconductivity nearby. And one of the advantages in this compound is that suppressing magnetism implies that there's a quantum critical point sitting under the superconducting dome that is accessible with ambient pressure, essentially. And that makes neutron scattering analysis much easier. It's also known that there's a magnetic propagation vector in the system, which is three-dimensional, and that the spin fluctuations are very isotropic. And for this compound, there also exist these renormalized bench structure calculations that relate the propagation vector of the magnetic phase to a nesting vector in the renormalized bench structure. And that suggests that the magnetic state arises from a standard three-dimensional spin density wave transition that the system undergoes at this quantum critical point. Okay. If that's true, then one can write down the essentially mean field expression for the order parameter susceptibility and conclude that the spin relaxation rate should go like T to 3/2. And this is what is seen if one analyzes the data, it goes like T to 3/2. And this is also in line with specific heat and transport data for this compound. You might be a little worried that there are 3 points and a fit of T to 3/2, but.
yeah. It's independently supported by resistivity also when we have T to 3/2.
Yeah, yeah. So, but what are. Trying to flash us that, in principle, you can look at the full scaling curve, and it does establish that there is a T to 3/2 in it. Okay, it's not just the 3 points. But there's inelastic neutron scattering, so in principle, one can now study the spectrum, the magnetic fluctuation spectrum, as a function of energy, both in the superconducting state with the gap, as well as in the normal state. Normal can be either above TC or in the magnetic field. And one can trace the gap. So this was done by Oliver Stockard, and it's the details are in this paper. And now one can ask, is that really paramagnetic mediated superconductivity, as suggested in 1986? And in order to answer this, one can study the energetics across the transition. This is what we did. We looked at the condensation energy, defined here, being the difference between the internal energy of the normal state and that of the superconducting state. And the normal state at T equals zero is a putative state since the system is superconducting. And what we did is we took the magnetic field data where superconductivity was suppressed as that for the normal state. And but one can also do extrapolations from above TC, and by and large, that is giving the same. Okay, so the condensation energy then is obtained. One gets a number, and this number should be compared to whatever drives superconductivity, which for the spin fluctuation mediated superconductivity would be the magnetic exchange. This was suggested in these three papers, and since the neutron scattering has the full spectrum in the normal state as well as the superconducting state. One can evaluate this expression. There's a coupling constant entering, which one has to pin down. This can be done in various ways, and by and large, one gets similar numbers. I'm not going through that in detail, but what one finds is that the change in exchange versus condensation energy is large. And that, first of all, means that indeed it is the magnetic fluctuations that drive superconductivity. But then one should also ask, where's this energy going? What is the kinetic energy doing in this case? Why is the factor so large? And if one believes in the, yeah?
Is it true that resonance peak has been measured on this material?
Yeah, there is, so this feature here, if you want to call it a resonance peak, then...
Well, it's a question, is it inside to date or above to date?
It's slightly above 2 delta.
Yeah, it's not resistive by definition.
So, but it's a three-dimensional superconductor, and therefore, right, I saw the propagation vector. So it's the full feature should be smeared anyway. But
yeah, this,
right?
Yeah. So sorry, how do you know delta so precisely? Delta being the superconducting gap, how do you know this so well?
It's basically from this neutron scattering
data. But wait a second. So if this is a peak, then it's just a magnetic gap, which is smaller than today's.
So can you hold the questions, because I think that that's easy.
Yeah,
we can finish now.
Yeah.
Sure.
Hold, yeah.
So, okay, we have this built-up, and one can ask, where is it coming from? If one takes the BCS equation and evaluates potential versus condensation energy, then it should be log of two characteristic energies, which are d pi and the size of the gap. And if you use that for CM kappa 2 silicon 2, then one gets from this relation something of the order of 2. Which is not of the order of 20. And of course, putting in slightly different numbers here, for example, a TK, which is 100 times larger, will not change that because of the log.
How do you know the prefactor?
If I have the gap equation, then I would have the prefactor. But again, unless, because to get a factor of 20, I cannot get it from here. But fitting this, it would mean I can. So the temperature dependence that one extracts does follow a BCS prediction. And yeah. Okay. So, and one way to think about this kinetic energy loss is now that because there's quantum physics and that happens in the spin sinker channel, that there should be competition between the D-wave superconductor and the physics that happens in the sinker channel from superconductivity and condo screening. And presumably, it's this competition that is responsible for this kinetic energy loss. And this brings me back to this E star line in the fact that because this star line is in energy or temperature very close by to the critical point, the superconductivity sort of probes it. And that then leads to this kinetic energy loss. And one way to sort of test that would be to go to CM kappa 2 indium 5, where at least suspects that there's a spin density wave like a critical point, and where there's STM data to help to resolve this issue. And if one asks how much information is in the single particle Green's function, then going back to a paper by Doug Scalapino and referred to by Mike Norman, one can actually get the condensation energy simply from the single particle Green's function via this expression. Now, in a condo system, this is because this is derived by equation of motion. This is not so straightforward because one has a two-band model, and the kinetic energy is the kinetic energy that involves condo singlet formation. But in principle, one should have the condensation energy and the kinetic energy, provided one has the dispersion, and that's where STM comes in and the QPI analysis that was reported in these two papers, which would in principle give access to kinetic energy and condensation energy. Okay, and that's basically the end of my talk. So STM allows to probe condo lattice formation. In principle, one sees or could see scaling properties. And since it's a non-equilibrium measurement in some sense, because the frequency dependence is actually a voltage dependence, and we are at quantum criticality, one would think that there should be also some features of non-thermal physics. And last but not least, it helps to probe this interplay of superconductivity and magnetism. So with that, thank you.
Okay. So questions? Next.
Can you return to the wireless data in a field?
Which one?
The STM data in a field for wireless? Yeah.
This one.
This one.
So, is it just me, or is there no very strong qualitative change?
So if you look at this, and yeah, it looks very similar. But if you follow this analysis, because you, in order to get the width of this peak, you first have to fit or subtract this overall zero bias gap, then this is what you get. But already this does indicate there's no strong field dependence.
So to see something like the Fermi surface reconstruction, we need to go, or Fermi surface collapse, we need to go to much lower temperature?
This is at .3 Kelvin, and as I said, if you for example look at the thermal power, it shows some feature below .1 Kelvin. It does increase. You saw the onset at around, that starts at 3 Kelvin. But it levels off only below .1 Kelvin. So in some sense, this is right at the threshold where critical physics starts to show. And it seems that if you would be able to go lower in temperature, these features should sort of increase further. So yeah, lower temperature.
Yes, but I would have thought that if I'm deeper in a phase, then maybe I should be able to distinguish a big Fermi surface from a
yeah, but to go, so if you look at this data up to 9 Tesla, you are never in the Fermi liquid phase. So you are not deep in any phase. You are all the time in this region above the quantum critical point. And in temperature, even below the upper cutoff where features should start. So this is really just the onset at that. And similar, if you go to small field, the ordering temperature is 17 millikelvin. So again, you have way above. But for this experiment, .3 is the base temperature, so it's hard.
So, yeah.
I was
going to
comment on the condensation energy factor of 20 or so. I think there's a similar factor, whether it's 10 or 20, in other materials, like cuprates, for example. So, it's not so clear to me that one picks that up in the condo. It seems that yeah. It occurs in some of the other systems also.
Yeah, it's true that similar factors have been obtained, for example, in the cuprates. But one paper that you are referring to, which is, for example, co-authored by Werner Hanke, and you may comment on this, the advantage here is if you look at some rules for the susceptibility, if you look at the spectrum, then we do obey them. So it seems that we sort of get the full spectrum. If you do that in the cuprates, you don't have it. Plus the fields are larger, and the question is what will they do? In some sense I question the results, but the question I want, the message I want to obey is here it's at least very controlled that we do have that number.
I agree. That was always the problem. Yeah. Here you can actually kill the superconductivity with the field.
So can I just check out, I've understood the logic of this, the first part of your talk on the tunneling. You see this 6 millivolt feature in tunneling, which seems to have a corresponding feature in thermal power, but not in specific heat. So does one infer from that you've got entropic degrees of freedom that are kind of that are moving from being localized, so presumably F character, to then becoming itinerant, which then contributes.
I'm not inferring this. Not at all.
So what do I learn from this?
The scale you do see here is reflected by a bulk property. So this is part of the bulk physics. And you hopefully accept this message that if you look at this through this as a function of field, you do see that there is something happening at the critical field, which is compatible with critical slowing down.
So why do I not see a feature in specific heat associated with the degrees of freedom?
In principle, at least when you have quasi particles, you would think that the thermal power and the specific heat sort of probe the same physics. But already in this paper, where the thermal power is compared to a specific heat, the message is that it's unconventional and one does not see this.
Yeah, but that's what I thought you were going to say. It was going from degrees of freedom which couldn't contribute to transport to ones that could. So there was a specific heat not changing meant it was a moving of fluctuations from one type to another. But that's not what you were trying to say.
No.
So let's move to Peter and then Andrea. So please.
General question from an outsider. How reliable is STM now as a probe of the formation of the heavy fermion state? And there are two parts to that question. Number one, I remember in the early days there was a rather vigorous discussion about the correct theoretical formulation for the tunneling problem. And then what about consistency with other measures of the hybridization gap, for example? Mm-hmm. Is that pretty well established now? We can sort of trust this analysis when it comes out again?
Well, as I said, so these features and scales are reflected in, for example, transport, as far as this is concerned.
And the temperature difference is also similar? You can track that, and they agree pretty well?
So the resistivity, for example, does have a maximum at 100 Kelvin, and that is due to crystal field excitation splittings, right? And
well, I'm not talking about crystal field effects. I'm talking about, sort of fermion effects.
So, if
you temperature hybridization gaps, those such things. Those are all showing up in STN. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
But I don't know whether I should believe them.
Fair enough. Coherence temperature. Depends on what you have in mind with coherence temperature. But since this experiment is never in a Fermi liquid state, it's a little bit hard to make statements. This feature, as I said, from the data it's clear it's bike and it's probably related to the development of the hybridization gap, which is sort of in line with these sort of calculations. And, I mean, you may believe that or you may not believe that. It's up to you, I think.
So I guess we can have the last question.
Just a question about Kiris. Since you mentioned that you are getting some rules in susceptibility, normally it implies integration over Q and over omega. So how far do you know experimental result in Q and how far do you know experimental result in omega?
I don't have the data here, but if one compares, as I said, I don't have the neutron scattering data here, but they are in the paper. But the neutron scattering data go up to 4 MeV, so they go very far out.
And momentum?
From not only from this experiment, but from previous experiments, one knows that there's only response of the spin fluctuations around the ordering wave threshold. So the statement would be there's nothing elsewhere. But again, since for this analysis, so for the sum rules, that is an issue that you see the full fluctuation spectrum. But since here you are concerned with the difference, whether there's a
balance. Yeah. But then you don't need sum rules.
Then you don't need sum rules. That's fine. But I just want, as a matter of principle, sum rules are operating this.
Isn't there an issue of the spin susceptibility should change only on the cues on the scale of the inverse superconductor current length? The superconductor at a larger Q is no different than the normal level.
Which is?
So it's a question of whether
So first of all, this is only at the ordering wave factor, but the experiment was done away from that as well, and you see how the signal decays with this. And from there you get the correlation length, that's fine. And the second remark refers to a recent paper of you where you took this, as far as I understand, data and did some Hirschberg theory, and you get exactly the The TC. That's fine, but then at least you would have to agree that the susceptibility measured is what it is, since it seems to reproduce the TC.
Okay, so I guess I need to move on to that. Let's hope. Okay.